This is the first of a series of three talks given at the 1970 summer school at Alcott on the three objects of the Theosophical Society. The title of this talk is Examination in Depth of the First Object, and the speaker is Miss Helen V. Zahara.
I think it's time to begin, and I have been allotted the task of opening this series of discussions on depth into our three objects. And we are taking one object in turn each of these three mornings. Of course, they all overlap, as no doubt you'll discover in listening to the speakers and also in your discussions. When I was asked to consider the first object in depth, I decided that the first thing to do was to see how the object evolved from the early days when the first rules were formulated. As I mentioned in a previous talk, the only object stated at the beginning of the society when it was founded was to collect and diffuse knowledge of the laws which govern the universe. But though not specifically stated in the object clause, in the preamble to the bylaws, we find these words. In considering the qualifications of applicants for membership, it, the society, knows neither race, sex, color, country, nor creed. Now, I think it's important to remember the climate that was here in the United States when that clause was written. It was in 1875, not so long after the Civil War, when the country was still probably very much divided over the issue of Negro rights, and segregation was probably widely effective. Seeing it in that context then, it was a very important and meaningful statement to insert in the preamble to our first bylaws, we might say a statement that was even courageous. The society, therefore, was founded on the premise of brotherhood, of love, of equality. We should be very proud of that fact and ask ourselves whether we are living up to that example of our founders. In 1875, while the founders, Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Alcott, were still in New York, the president founder, Colonel Alcott, issued his first circular explaining the origin and plan of the society and the aims for which it stood. And we now find that he gives the third object of the society as, quote, chiefly to aid in the institution of a brotherhood of humanity, wherein all good and pure men will recognize each other as the equal effects upon this planet of one uncreate, universal, infinite, and everlasting cause. So we should note that in that statement made way back in the early days of the society, not only was there the humanitarian approach to brotherhood, but the truth of brotherhood was being recognized as a fact of existence based on a deeply philosophical and esoteric statement that all people are equal effects upon this planet of one uncreate, universal, infinite, and everlasting cause. This same truth was presented and expanded later in the Secret Doctrine, but here it is now, 10 years before the publication of the Secret Doctrine. It was early in 1879, when the founders had gone to India, that the first redraft of the rules was made. Then a second and more extensive revision took place at Benares in December, when a meeting of the General Council of the Society occurred. The Society was now actually calling itself the Theosophical Society, or Universal Brotherhood. And Universal Brotherhood had now become the Society's first object. Its statement of principles, rules, and bylaws opened with these words. The Theosophical Society is formed upon the basis of a universal brotherhood of humanity. Now, it's not just to form a nucleus, but it is formed on the basis of universal brotherhood. Further on, along with other declared aims, we find that the society's plans also include to promote a feeling of brotherhood among nations. The fellows of the society at that time were divided into three divisions of membership, which are very interesting. They entered the third section as probationers. Then, here is an interesting requirement. Only those fellows who became, quotes, able to regard all men as equally their brothers, end quotes, might pass into the second section. The first section was composed exclusively of proficients or initiates in esoteric science and philosophy. These were the teachers of Madame Blavatsky, who instructed her and stood behind the founders in the development of the society. So you see, in those early days, brotherhood was considered to be so important that those who could not accept it could not move from the probationary to the second division of membership. Later, these divisions into different sections of membership were dropped, and also in 1885, the characteristic of the society as a secret one was also eliminated. In 1881, on February 17 in Bombay, a further revision and clarification of the objects was made, and the first object was reduced to this one sentence: to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity. In 1886, the first object was amended once more to ensure that there be no distinctions, and it read, to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, or color. This was further explained in one of the accompanying rules. The society being formed on a basis of universal brotherhood inculcates perfect tolerance. It was in 1888 that the words sex and caste were added, presumably being considered necessary in India, especially where women were not then emancipated and the division of caste was still very rigid. Our founders were helping to break down these barriers. So here we have the Theosophical Society taking a pioneer role. Our first object now stated to form the nucleus of a universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. In 1896, the final change in the first object was made. Instead of to form the nucleus, this became a nucleus, and instead of a universal brotherhood, it became the universal brotherhood of humanity. And so the articles the and a became transposed. It would be interesting, wouldn't it, to know some of the thinking that went into the evolution of the object and its careful attention to the wording. In 1905, the society was incorporated without any further change in the first object, which has remained the same ever since, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. Now, I've brought out here, as you'll see on the table, a charter of a lodge or branch. And you'll notice that the name of the society is not just the Theosophical Society, but the words and universal brotherhood appear. Now, this doesn't appear in our rules and regulations, but there it is on the charter of every branch. Have you ever examined the charter of your branch and noticed this, showing the import of this first object in relation to the actual existence of our society? And I have a theory which I mentioned yesterday, that possibly the words universal brotherhood there may also refer not only to the concept of brotherhood and the fact of brotherhood in nature, but to the existence of a universal brotherhood of humanity which stands behind mankind, the perfected men, and which influenced our founders in the society's creation and development, and that we are also within a links in some way linked and a nucleus of that universal brotherhood. We must remember that, has already been mentioned, that at the time when the society was founded, and since then, there has been the concept of what has been called these inner founders. Whether we accept that outwardly or not, it is not a dogma of the society. But our early founders certainly believed it. And these adept brothers or teachers were giving esoteric wisdom to the Western world, mainly through their pupil, H.B. Blavatsky, but also so through their letters to A.P. Sinnott and others. And if you study their writings, you will find that their teachings, their letters, are full of references to brotherhood and to the society's role in exemplifying and promulgating it. Here are a few examples. The Mahatma K.H. to Mr. Sinnott. The term universal brotherhood is no idle phrase. It is the only secure foundation for universal morality. Again, the chiefs want a brotherhood of humanity, a real universal fraternity started. In those early days, the appearance of letters from the Mahatmas and the phenomena which HBB was able to produce were attracting many people who were interested in occult knowledge for themselves or who were excited by phenomena alone and not by any altruistic motives. It was made clear by our leaders and by the Mahatmas that the society was not founded to be a hall of magic and that only those who could grasp the idea of brotherhood could be entrusted to the deeper esoteric knowledge, thus using it for the benefit of mankind and not for themselves. The Mahatma Maurya made this very clear in a letter to Mr. Sinnott in 1882. Quote, "The situation is this. Men who join the society with the one selfish object of reaching power, making occult science their only or even chief aim, may as well not join it. They are doomed to disappointment as much as those who commit the mistake of letting them believe that the society is nothing else. It is just because they preach too much the brothers and too little, if at all, brotherhood, that they fail." There are many other quotations to be found in the letters. I can't read all of them, of course. I'll mention just one more. The famous one from the Mahatma K.H., where he gives the views of the Mahat Chohan in 1880 or 1881. Quote, "If theosophists say the lower classes and the inferior races cannot concern us and must manage for themselves, what becomes of our fine profession of benevolence, reform, etc.? Perish rather the Theosophical Society than we should permit it to become no better than an academy of magic and a hall of occultism." So you see that the society had a special role to play in demonstrating within itself and in its work and in its literature the goal of brotherhood as a principle, an ideal, and a reality. While these letters were being received, HBB was herself speaking in a similar vein. In an article published in 1886, entitled The Original Program of the TS, she referred to the objects of the society as 1. Universal brotherhood, 2. No distinction to be made by the member between races, creeds, or social positions. Of course, there were other aims also, which I won't go into today. In a letter to the Second American Convention held in Chicago, April 22 to 23, 1888, she wrote, among other things, and I quote, "On the day when theosophy will have accomplished its most holy and most important mission, namely to unite firmly a body of men of all nations in brotherly love, bent on a purely altruistic work, not on a labor with selfish motives, on that day will theosophy become higher than any nominal brotherhood of man. This will be a wonder and miracle truly, for the realization of which humanity is vainly waiting for the last 18 centuries and which every association has hitherto failed to accomplish. There is a challenging statement. No other organization has managed to achieve brotherhood. Has ours also been in gone the same way? Have we managed to achieve it, what no other organization could do? A question we might well ask ourselves. HBB was accompanying her words with actions, as were her co-founder Colonel Olcott and others. Their proclamation of brotherhood in India was making a tremendous impact. At that time, there was division among the Europeans and Indians, among the different sects, religions, and castes. And here came two people from the West proclaiming the brotherhood of man, of races, and of religions. HBB in 1889 wrote in Lucifer of the work that was done in the 10 years that followed their arrival in India. The unprecedented gathering of races, castes, and sects, both in India and Ceylon. The rapid growth of theosophical literature advocating their altruistic views. And then the carrying of the same message to Japan, which she described as ranking, quotes, among the most dramatic events in history. She stated that it was, quote again, the all-sufficient, unanswerable, and crowning proof of the vital reality of our scheme to beget the feeling of universal brotherhood among all peoples, races, kindreds, castes, and colors, end quote. Now, I'm not saying that the scheme came to fruition. If it had, we would not be in the sorry state that we find our world today, and our society itself would be more vital in its expression of brotherhood. Yet there was no doubt whatever that the society and its leaders had made at that time a profound impact. They were stirring people to a realization of their interdependence. They were breaking down barriers of creed as well as of color. There was a pioneer effort to break down sectarian, caste, racial, and color boundaries. Their humanitarian work, of course, was carried on in India in particular by the second president of the society, Dr. Annie Besant, and her co-workers. D.L. Murray, former editor of the London Times Literary Supplement, writing of HBB, recognized this marvelous contribution of our early leaders. He said, "Brotherhood is the most living of all issues." And writing at a period, the 1870s and 1880s, when the idea of a large-scale international unity was very faint, when indeed the relative poverty of communications made the people of the earth far more widely separate than they can possibly be today, it was the leaders of the Theosophical movement who put their finger upon what was to prove the most urgent need of the future, the one creative idea for world politics. That's from D.L. Murray, former editor of the London Times Literary Supplement. While this humanitarian effort was going and moving along, the stream of esoteric teaching on the nature of man and his relationship with the universe was also being published. A metaphysical system was emerging which gave the rationale for brotherhood as being a reality of existence as well as a philanthropic aim and ideal. HBB, for instance, spoke of the presence of an impalpable Proteus, omnipotent in its ubiquity throughout all kingdoms of nature, including man. Proteus, indivisible in its essence and eluding form, yet appearing under all and every form, who is here and there, and everywhere and nowhere, is all and nothing, ubiquitous yet one, universal essence, binding, bounding, containing everything, contained in all. It is sufficient, she said, to recognize these truths to be a theosophist. For this recognition is tantamount to admitting that not only humanity, composed, it is, she said, of thousands of races, but everything that lives and vegetates. In short, everything that is made of the same essence and substance, is animated by the same spirit, and that consequently, everything in nature, whether physical or moral, is bound in solidarity. The Mahatma K.H. to Mr. A. O. Hume, which was received in a letter received July 10, 1882, likewise spoke of infinite life, the source of all life, visible and invisible, an essence inexhaustible, ever present. A great truth which is so basic to all our understanding of our existence. In 1888, HBB published her magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine, which laid out the basic principles on which the whole edifice of esoteric teaching is built. In the proem, there is the clear statement that there is one life, eternal, invisible, yet omnipresent, without beginning or end, the one self-existent reality. In the third proposition of the secret doctrine, we find this basic concept of linked with the idea of all of us, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul, the latter being itself an aspect of the unknown root. There is the basis of brotherhood. All are part of the one reality. Man, according to this statement, is identical with the universal oversoul, which is an aspect of the unknown root. That is brotherhood in its ultimate meaning. But despite this identity of every soul with the oversoul, the one divine consciousness, it is clearly stated that every individual is embarked on a pilgrimage and is governed by the law of karma, of action and reaction, cause and effect. Each one is evolving by the process of reincarnation, so it is said, in an ever-increasing spiral toward a state of complete unfoldment. Man is described as a god in the becoming, a miniature universe, a microcosm of the macrocosm, and his potentialities are beyond our possible imagining. The secret doctrine then goes on to elaborate upon the whole process of universal unfoldment in which all forms are involved. We find that each unit, including man, is part of a great evolving whole, is an expression of and subject to the same universal laws. All are links in an endless chain of existence with no apparent beginning and no apparent end. But now a problem arises. Now our troubles begin. A paradox. In elaborating the evolutionary path of man and his many cycles, the secret doctrine and the Mahatma letters introduce the idea of a septenary law, which includes seven root races, each with its own seven sub-races. I can't go into all the aspects of the septenary laws related to man's constitution and so on. I want to deal with this aspect today. Each root race is said to be a phase of human unfoldment and development in which a new sense is developed and a new corresponding level of consciousness. I hope I don't get too controversial, maybe it's a good idea, but I think it was very unfortunate indeed that the term root race was chosen to describe these phases of human development, as it has led to so much misunderstanding, which still exists, I regret to say, in many cases. Of course, none of us, I don't claim to know the teaching fully myself. The word root race has often been confused with the use of the general term race, It seems that there was no nomenclature to describe the developmental phases when the teachings were being given by the Mahatmas. For in letter number 14, received by Mr. A.O. Hume from Mahatma K.H. in July 1882, there is this phrase. M advised Mr. Sinnett strongly to agree upon a nomenclature before going any further. In letter number 12 to Mr. Sinnett, the Mahatma M wrote, by the by, you ought to come to some agreement as to the terms used when discussing upon cyclic evolutions. Our terms are untranslatable. Then there's one passage in letter number 13 where the Mahatma K.H. is evidently not pleased with the use of the word race, which he capitalized in this passage. The present mankind is at its fourth round. Mankind as a genus or a kind, not a race, nota bene, of the post-Pelian cycle of evolution. In another letter, when discussing the question of racial evolution to Mr. Sinnett, the Mahatma K.H. says, quote, it is possible that my nomenclature is faulty. You are at liberty in such a case to change it. Unfortunately, because of the development of history, the term was not changed, and it was adopted and carried over into the secret doctrine and later literature. This would have been all right if the definition had been clarified and if it had kept to its original concept of each retrace relating to a new phase of human development in which the whole of mankind shared, that is, the unfoldment of each new sense and level of consciousness. There crept in, however, other connotations. Each root race became identified with specific ethnic groups. People became labeled and pigeonholed because of the color of their skin. And this led to the danger of unconscious racism being injected into our understanding of this teaching, into our wonderful philosophy. It has, in fact, and I've heard it, being used by some to justify their racist views, and the real meaning of the unfoldment of man as a God in the becoming has been overlaid with concepts not befitting a brotherhood organization. There has often been too much emphasis on the distinctions and differences of forms instead of the unity of the spiritual selves within. Let's just look very briefly at the basic teaching of the root races as far as the development of man is concerned, and then consider whether these statements apply to the whole of humanity or just to part of it. If they apply to the whole of humanity, then all humanity shares in the developmental phases, and all root races unfolded so far are in all men, irrespective of so-called race or color or ethnic background. This isn't to say, of course, that there are not different stages of development for individuals within all ethnic groups. It would be absurd to say that we are all exactly alike. We are all on the evolutionary ladder, but we cannot judge a person's place on that ladder or his root race consciousness by the color of his skin or his ethnic background. Because it seems to me that the root race refers to the phase of our consciousness. And this has nothing to do with our ethnic group. The first root race began to bring into activity the first sense, we are told, that of hearing. This was non-physical. It must have been a rudimentary sense on the astral or etheric plane. The second root race brought into development the second sense, that of touch. It was still only formative and ethereal. These first two root races, we are told, began to develop the capacity to comprehend sensation and perception. It was only during the third root race, known as the Lemurian, about 18 million years ago, according to occult teaching, that physical man with a bony structure as we know him today was evolved. There occurred the beginning of mentality, the development of emotion, the separation of the sexes, the development of speech, and the sense of sight. In the fourth root race, the Atlantean, There was said to be the development of lower mind and the sense of taste. The fifth fruit race has seen the awakening of the higher mind and the sense of smell. And we are told that the sixth fruit race will begin the development of intuition and perhaps that wider consciousness of which Joyce spoke, and the sense of clairvoyance. In the seventh fruit race will come the faculty of direct perception and the sense of clairaudience. All these are part of man's latent faculties. And when we hear the phrase used by our speakers and in our literature of a new race now forming, surely it is a race of a new consciousness among men, not a new race in the ethnic sense. Now it does seem that the focus of each developmental phase or root race has been among certain groups of peoples. It is as if a searchlight had rested in one area, but from there had spread out to include all. And so we are told that the cradle of the Lemurian race was in the Pacific Ocean and stretched through what is now Central Africa. The fourth root race, it is said, had its cradle in Atlantis and reached its peak about 1 million years ago. The fifth root race, called the Aryan, but again, not the limited idea of Aryan, but in the broader sense, or Indo-European, is said to have risen in Central Asia. It is now only in its fifth sub-race. Now we can see very clearly today that we are in the age of science, which is related to the development of mind. And this is, in turn, has expressed itself through the wonders of technology, culminating in the journey to the moon. But because technology has developed in the West, and is evident most of all here, perhaps in the United States, this doesn't mean that other people don't have the same potentialities, does it, given the same circumstances? There are people from Africa and from Asia who are great scientists and thinkers. China has developed the nuclear bomb, which may not please us, but this shows that technology is being developed there, that they have that capability. Japan is fast rising as one of the great industrial giants. So the technological mind does not belong to just one ethnic group, though a particular culture may give it more emphasis than others. HBB makes it clear that there is an enormous overlapping of one root race over the root race that succeeds it. And the older root races take on the characteristics of the younger. As she puts it, I quote, "The races, sub-races, etc., down to their smallest ramifications, overlap and are entangled with each other until it is nearly impossible to separate them." Unfortunately, we have to admit that even HBB, in some passages, equates root races with ethnic groups, and we find some of these ideas perpetuated in our later literature. For instance, some of the African people and the Australian Aborigines are described as remnants of the last descendants of the third root race. References are made throughout our literature to the Australian Aborigines as dying out. And this is given as an example of the third root race, of the extinction of the third root race, since we are told the egos have passed into bodies of later root races. And sometimes we are told that the later ones are higher bodies. This idea is given also by such writers as Annie Besant and C.W. Leadbeater. Now we have to remember that when HBB was writing The Secret Doctrine, communication with Australia was practically nil. Distances were great. Knowledge about the Australian Aborigines was very limited. With the coming of the white settlers, the Aborigines were pushed out of their traditional tribal lands, and so naturally they began to die out. But now the situation has changed. Their numbers are increasing, and their population is expected to double by the end of this decade. So we can't go on saying they're dying out, because it just isn't true. I mention this because sometimes we take statements in our literature as absolute truth and repeat them without looking into the real facts as they are today. Now, we can understand how HBB did it. She had a great truth to give forth in relation to consciousness and unfoldment. And at that time, scientific knowledge was that the Australian Aborigines were dying out, so she took the scientific knowledge of her day and used it in describing some of the things that she was talking about. So we can't blame her for doing that. But it is not correct today, so we shouldn't go on quoting these statements and realize that while the principles are there, the outer details are not necessarily scientifically correct. And so we have to look at it again and see what is really meant by the Australian Aborigines and African tribes and others being remnants of descendants of the third root race. Since it was 18 million years ago, we are told, when the third root race was flourishing, obviously the descendants of those people are not the same as their ancestors were. We cannot equate them with the third root race. They have evolved and have changed along with the rest of humanity. They have taken on the characteristics of the later root races. Let's follow this thought with a little logic and see if it can be true. As we have said, and you'll find in the Secret Doctrine, the first three root races developed the senses of hearing, touch, and sight. Since the Aborigines have these senses, we will agree that they are at least third root race. The fourth root race, which goes back more than 1 million years, it is said developed taste. The Aborigines have this sense, so they also have this fourth root race quality. Now the fifth root race, over some thousands of years, it is said developed the sense of smell, and this sense also exists with the Australian Aborigines and with the Africans. So they also have the fifth root race qualities, senses which have nothing to do with colour. I'm not trying to say, of course, that the Australian Aborigines have the technology of the Western civilization. It would be absurd to say that. From that point of view, they may be described as primitive, still living close to nature. They were isolated, remember, for thousands of years. But that doesn't mean that they haven't developed intelligence and a culture of their own with art and religion and moral standards. It is well known by anyone who studies them that they do have these. Yet listen to what appears in our theosophical books, sold in our TPH, lent from our library. It's from popular lectures by Annie Besant, but it appears in other works as well. This is what she says. Let us look at a primeval savage and try for a moment to realize what he is. Take any savage of the lowest type. The Aborigines of Australia, the Vedas of Ceylon, the hairy men of Borneo. They are scarcely human, yet they are human. Their language is more of signs and of sounds, expression of emotion than of words. It is really little better than the language of an ape that some have learned to reproduce. Try to realize him mentally and morally. He has practically no mind and no morals, only the germ of them. Now that was written many years ago, and it may have been the understanding that was written, but should we go on publishing books that contain statements like that, which are so wrong and make us look ridiculous and absurd? Let me read now from the Dreamtime, Australian Aboriginal Myths, with text by Charles Mountford. Quote, from the standpoint of material possessions, the Aborigines of Australia are without doubt the poorest of any people. This material poverty has led to the mistaken impression that, as the white man uses so many, and the Aborigines so few tools with which to gain a livelihood, the Aborigines must have the lesser intelligence. But this idea is completely refuted on an examination of the success of the food gathering of the Aborigines in the almost waterless deserts of Central Australia, a country so arid that no man, white man, can live there unless he takes his own food. Yet, with no more than 5 tools, the Aborigines have been able to live and to multiply in this harsh and unfriendly country for many centuries. This is surely evidence not only of normal intelligence, but of minds intensely trained in the law of the desert. To meet these conditions, the natives must acquire a profound knowledge of the rhythm of their country. The Aborigines have also developed a calendar based on the movements of the heavenly bodies, the flowering of certain trees and grasses, the mating calls of the local birds, and the arrivals of the migrant ones, all showing intelligence and relationship and deduction. This UNESCO book on Aboriginal paintings from Australia, which by the way is on sale in our TPH, also by Charles P. Mountford, has valuable information on the cultural and aesthetic values of the Aborigines. He says, even in the forbidding deserts, they succeed in gaining not only an adequate livelihood, but also sufficient leisure to follow a rich aesthetic and ceremonial life in which they commemorate their philosophies concerning the origin of their world, an intimate knowledge of the mythical stories concerning creation is transmitted from one generation of Aborigines to the next by means of the art, music, and drama of their ceremonial life. And then he makes this important statement, which I think we can well remember when evaluating some of the statements in our literature about the Aborigines and other descendants of the Third Root race. Quote, it has been asserted by some that men and women living at this stage of development are almost devoid of artistic appreciation, their thoughts rising little higher than the gathering of food and the perpetuation of their species. The research of others, however, has shown that primitive man, of which the Australian Aborigine is an excellent example, is as sensitive in the creation of beauty, particularly the beauty of the graphic arts, as is any other race. Now, what brute race would you say has a monopoly on an appreciation of beauty, art, and drama? Is technology superior, or is it just another emphasis of human activity? You see, we must not equate any of these accomplishments with superiority or inferiority. They are all part of the qualities which men must develop, all men, to reach their full potentiality. Now, to refer again to this idea of overlapping and the older races taking on the qualities of the newer ones, I'm going to show you now a painting in Western style by a full-blooded Australian Aborigine. I hope you'll come up later and really look at it. This is a print of a watercolour painting by Albert Namatjira, an Aranda tribesman. And he's not unique. There are many Aborigines who are producing beautiful paintings in Western style. It is entitled Gateway to the South, Alice Springs, Heavy Tree Gap in Central Australia. You can see there his sense of colour and proportion and beauty. Now, is that the consciousness of one who is just little more than an animal, as Australian Aborigines are described in the book I quoted and elsewhere in our literature? Or is this an expression of the fifth developmental phase of consciousness? He may not have developed great technology, but he certainly learned the technique of Western art. Whether that's better than their own inherent art is another matter, but at least it shows that the capacity exists. So I believe that we have committed some very grave and hurtful errors in our interpretation of the very mysterious subject of the root races. I hope that some of you have been reading the articles appearing in recent issues of the American Theosophist. Personally, I feel the time has now come for a re-evaluation of our understanding of this teaching. Now, I don't mean we should throw it out, because obviously the septenary development of mankind is an integral part of the occult system. But we need to dig into it more and see what it really means. I think what Jeffrey Barborka has said in the February 1970 issue of the American Theosophist is very meaningful. quote, "The term races is responsible for confusion on the subject. The word does not convey the meaning intended, especially when the prefix root is omitted, as very often happens. For that matter, the ethnic connotation destroys what theosophists mean by root races." Now, I deliberately chose to speak on the Australian Aborigines because I could then remove the discussion from our emotional biases and prejudices. I think, however, that we should relate this discussion to our race problems nearer at hand, and to make sure that we do not ever think of someone of another color or of another so-called race or ethnic group as not having the same potentiality as we ourselves have. Never to think of someone else as inferior while others are superior. Obviously, within all groups, there are some who are more spiritually mature than others. But this maturity has nothing to do with the color of skin or the ethnic background and of any such distinction. As HBB says, and I quote, and this is from The Secret Doctrine, "The reason given for dividing humanity, superior and inferior races, falls to the ground and becomes a fallacy," end quote. So let us look at our ideas again and perhaps re-examine this idea of the root race as a phase in human unfoldment in which we all share and experience. How wondrous is this concept in its larger sense? And because I quoted from Dr. Besant that unfortunate statement, I don't want to leave it there, her there, because she has made some wonderful statements against racism, so I want to quote from her again from a different work, Talks on the Path of Occultism, where she says, "This is a thing that aspirants to the path should never forget, for unless it is lived, you are still very far from the portal. There is no one will ask what your race is or your creed, but only what you have added to your character in the way of qualities." And she continues, "Each race has its part to play in the harmony. Each contributes to the mighty whole. If people understood this, they would be less prone to foolish pride of race and criticism of other races." Now, in dealing with the subject this morning, I haven't even touched, of course, on the modern scientific view of race. But let me just say that it is now acknowledged that all men today belong to the same species and descend from the same stock. The species is Homo sapiens. There is only one race, the human race, even though within the species, anthropology recognizes various ethnological groups. Yet these are all part of mankind, and their external differences are only relative. We have been accused by some of presenting theosophy as from the head rather than from the heart. Is it because of this that our society seems to talk a lot about brotherhood, and yet its voice is not heard loud and clear at a time when the world is torn by racial prejudice as well as religious strife and warfare? Are we hiding behind our neutrality and freedom of thought, and thus failing to make our first object a reality? Our first object, as we have discussed, seeks a brotherhood which transcends race, creed, and color. And therefore, I cannot help but ask myself, why is the society not in the forefront of a worldwide effort to break down racism and a really creative effort to work for brotherhood? Where are our love, our concern, our compassion? Mahatma K.H. spoke of the adept's immense love for humanity as a whole. For it is humanity which is the great orphan. The occult teachings, while giving this wonderful outline of the evolutionary scheme, are full of appeal to the heart. You remember those beautiful words in the Voice of the Silence. "Let not the fierce sun dry one tear of pain, before thyself has wiped it from the sufferer's eye. But let each burning human tear drop on thy heart and there remain, nor ever brush it off until the pain that caused it is removed. These tears, O thou most heart most merciful, these are the streams that irrigate the fields of charity immortal. And our President Sri Ram has said, to open one's heart, to become resistless and barrierless, is the means of true understanding, as well as of pouring out any possible help. Let the kingdom of your heart be so wide that no one is excluded. In discussing the first object this morning, I have dealt with it mainly from the point of view of occult concepts in our literature, because this literature plays such a vital part in our work and in our understanding of it, and so it can color what we mean when we think of a nucleus without distinctions and what we mean by brotherhood. It can condition us in our understanding. Some of these concepts, if narrowly understood, can create the very psychological barriers which stand in the way of a true brotherhood which our first object contemplates, which emphasize the very distinctions we are trying to overcome. How can we achieve a dynamic nucleus while we continue to look at each other with vision blurred with artificial distinctions? The real state of an evolutionary state of an individual is not dependent on his color or ethnic background, but on the unfoldment of his spiritual vision. The man who is a brother to all men is a real nucleus in his heart, his soul. And a group of men and women also form a nucleus which excludes no one in its sphere if they also provide that same approach. Our society then can be a nucleus for the brotherhood of man and for the brotherhood of the spirit, for the universal brotherhood of just men made perfect, whose influence and aid the world so greatly needs. Only, of course, as we are peaceful and harmonious ourselves, can we be channel for the forces of unity and love. Now, while we are still far from achieving the reality of our first object, we can also express our ideal of brotherhood in action and involvement. And the group which is meeting in the afternoons with Mary Rose is developing practical ways to do this. In addition, we have a National Committee on Universal Brotherhood. Just before closing, mention what HBB said about the society when she was asked about the future prospects of the society. She pointed out the danger of it degenerating into a sect. But if this danger be averted, she says, then the society will live on and through the 20th century. It will gradually leaven and permeate the great mass of thinking of intelligent people with its large-minded and noble ideas of religion, duty, and philanthropy. Slowly but surely, it will burst asunder the iron fetters of creeds and dogmas, of social and caste prejudice. It will break down racial and national antipathies and barriers, and will open the way to the practical realization of the brotherhood of all. That, I believe, is the first object in a nutshell. I would like now to close on a high note by reading a short poem. And I'm wondering whether I should tell you what root race the author comes from, or what race or ethnic background, as to whether it will change your reaction. Surely we can accept it for what it is, its truth and its yearning. It is by an American Negro, Langston Hughes, and is entitled, I Dream a World. I dream a world where man no other will scorn, where love will bless the earth and peace its paths adorn. I dream a world where all will know sweet freedom's way, where greed no longer saps the soul, nor avarice blights our day. world I dream, where black or white, whatever race you be, will share the bounties of the earth, and every man is free. Where wretchedness will hang its head, and joy like a pearl, attend the needs of all mankind. Of such I dream, our world. Thank you.